bicycle kick. Goal! Rowdy, what a play, what a shot, and it's touch to be had. Aaron Guillen, Lasso, elevating.
It's Tampa Bay Rowdies who have made a huge upset.
And now, you're tuned into Tampa Bay's RBLR Sports.
And yes, this is RBLR Sports coming at you tonight with brand new music, with a brand new intro video.
Wow.
If you are not on the YouTube, you need to get on the YouTube and join us there. We do not have a brand new co-host, but we do have a guest this night because, Carlos, I think that you and I, generally we talk about the Rowdies and generally we talk about things that are very pertinent to the Rowdies. In fact, you and I had a chance to interview a Tampa Bay Rowdy only this past week. And we're not going to do any of that. We're not going to talk about any of that tonight. There is bigger news that we have to get to. And I'm not talking about the soccer news out of Greenland that I was just reading about before we started recording, unfortunately.
What?
We'll talk about that another time, I'm sure. Tonight, we have to talk about the USL organization as a whole, because last week, the most momentous, bombastic, biggest news that could possibly come out of the USL finally dropped. I'm sure a lot of people were expecting it. And here we are, finally, yes, several days late, RBLR, to talk about it. I'm here with Carlos and our guest, Kartik. Kartik, you are a regular contributor in the USL space and an insider with good knowledge, so we appreciate having you on. Let me start with him. Kartik, how are you doing tonight?
Jennings tonight, and his move to Charleston, but maybe that's for next week.
Oh yeah, that'll probably be yet another thing that we have to push for tonight's discussion. Carlos, how are you doing this evening? Leaving aside anything done by Cal Jennings.
Well, James, I'm doing all right. That's true. I mean, I totally almost forgot about the Cal Jennings stuff in the midst of the USL like shakeup, right? There is still a USL championship season coming up soon. That is still happening. But I'm doing well. I am thrilled to see the fun new intro put together by producer Eureka. That's fun. Lots of great memories in there. That was a good video. If you're not watching on like Twitter and you see the video or YouTube, that's a fun one. Go back and watch that. It'll make your heart feel happy. From some good times as a Rowdies fan. But James, I'm doing well. It's cold up here in Northern Virginia. I want to go home to Florida. And soon enough, I'll be back for a few games this season. But yeah, big news to talk about here. I'm thrilled. Kartik, thanks for joining us again. You and I have chatted a few times now. You even helped me with a final project I had during my senior year. So it's great to chat with you again. And yeah, this is big news, James. There's so much to talk about here and so many question marks and things to just figure out as we navigate this potential, 2027 start date? Was that what we had?
Looking at.
Yeah, so we'll get there in a second, but I'm doing well. Before we jump into any of that, we have to throw in a shameless plug here to like and subscribe to us on YouTube, where maybe you're watching this, or any major platform where you see your social media content. Twitter, X, Blue Sky, Instagram, Facebook, we're there. Give us a follow, like, and subscribe to us, and get your content regularly from this lovely team. And as much as I wish we had Kartik here every week, enjoy it, because it's a rare occasion to get his knowledge on. James and I kind of stumble through every week, but at least we have someone who knows what they're talking about this week. Shameless plug, liking and subscribing is free, but if you need some new threads, you can support this podcast by heading over to shop.rblrsports.com and checking out all the designs cooked up over there. There's Rowdies content, Rays content, Lightning, Tampa Bay Sun, who are fully in the middle of their season now on the back half. So fun. They're coming up to DC next month, so I'm really thrilled about that. That'll be fun. Promo code COYR for 10% off your purchase. Go ahead and check it out. Okay, all the shameless plugs and ads for our own stuff aside, let's talk about this. Let's get into this before we do any rowdy stuff or do anything else. The most important thing is this USL shakeup. Where do we even start with this, James?
Yeah, so we're going to get to having Kartik talk about a little bit more of this because, like I said, he is a true insider with the league and has a lot more knowledge probably than Carlos or I do. But I want to do the technical stuff first here. The technical stuff is the original announcement last week in an interview with Paul Tenorio of The Athletic, the league commissioner. League president, not commissioner. They're different terms always. But the league president, Paul McDonough, said that the USL is going to start a first division men's league like they did on the women's side. Last year, previously, they started the USL Super League on the women's side. And it is a, I don't know if they consider themselves competitors or partners or something that's right next to the NWSL here in America, but they start another Division One league on the women's side. They have requirements on the men's and women's side to fulfill to be a Division One league, and those aren't necessarily what you would think they are. It also doesn't mean that the U.S. Soccer Federation has to vote on it or anything like that. It's if you meet the requirements, then you can be a Division I league, as far as I understand. So I just wanted to list those real fast here. The Division I league standards on the men's side, according to the U.S. Soccer Federation. And I want to say shout out to John Morrissey, who put this together, and I'm going to crib a little bit off of his article here. 12 member clubs at launch, 14 by the third year of operation, 75% of clubs located in a metro area with a population exceeding 1 million people. The capacity of each club stadium must exceed 15,000. That is a very important one. Keep that in the back of your mind. And it must be actively operating in at least 3 time zones. Before I turn it over to Kartik, I also want to say there are currently only 2 teams in the USL at any division that meet at least the stadium requirements. And those are Miami FC with a 23,500 capacity in their stadium and Birmingham Legion of a 47,100 capacity. So those are the 2 teams that could currently, as far as I'm aware, meet the requirements. And there's all sorts of other stadium stuff to get into that we're going to talk about down the line. But Kartik, I'm going to turn it over to you now and jump us off into this discussion of the new USL Division I Premier League of America soccer something something.
Yeah, we assume it's going to be the USL Premier League because they've done the naming convention to match the EFL, right? Championship, right. League One, League Two, Super League, right? Just like Women's Super League in the UK. In fact, I had my WSL, my handy WSL Panini guide.
There we go.
For the season. So the thing that's really important to keep in mind with this is that this is something USL has been thinking about for 2 or 3 years. That's why I wasn't totally caught off guard by the announcement. The timing was interesting. Actually put an article together last month at Beyond the 90, speculating on what this league might look like. But that was just taking existing USL championship clubs and moving them up. My understanding now from talking to people is that we're looking at, in year one, 12 to 14 clubs, probably 8 of which will be existing championship clubs. 4, maybe 6 will be expansion teams. So totally new clubs. Now, I think that's very difficult to do by 2027 if you're bringing in new teams. So maybe realistically, we're looking at 2028 for a launch. But if they're leaning more into existing USL championship clubs and maybe, let's say, the 4 expansion teams or projects already underway, Dallas and Garland, Texas, the Atlanta project, Jacksonville, then you're Milwaukee potentially, then maybe you're there a little more easily. But I think the thing that's really important to understand is USL at a broader level feels like they need this to get sponsorship deals, to they've got good TV deals now for a lower division league, but they'd like to be more prominent in that media space. And they also feel like in order to get some more outside investment, not just with individual clubs, but with leagues, with the league itself, and then potentially getting some more political and chamber of commerce, like local chamber of commerce, business muscle behind some of their stadium projects, they need to have a Division I league attached to their league system. So this was sort of an inevitable thing. Whether it involves promotion and relegation is still to be seen. My understanding is they'd like to do that, but initially it probably will be a standalone closed league. You mentioned, James, the two clubs that meet the requirements in terms of stadium. One of them, Miami FC, and this was part of my work with them last season when I worked with them as a consultant, is getting them out of that larger stadium.
Right.
With new soccer-specific dedicated facility. So they won't meet the requirements probably by 2027. And Birmingham, we know, wants out of that stadium also. That stadium is protective stadium is an eyesore. But in terms of the 15,000 seat requirement, Sacramento is building a new stadium that they're hoping or working on a stadium project that they're hoping will be ready for 2027. Now, they are very naturally the very first team in the USL Championship that would go to a Division I league. They operate like a Division I level club. They're a club that already competes with Major League Soccer in terms of bringing in youth players. We'll see how that works with Neil Collins, because we know he's not big on youth. We saw with the Rowdies, but he's going to have to be in Sacramento because that's part of their club mantra. But then who the other seven or eight USL Championship clubs are, that I think is an open discussion. And Tampa Bay certainly will be in that mix and in that conversation.
Now, everything that you said there is important to keep in mind as we keep going, but I do want to try and focus on a couple of individual pieces. And the one thing that you mentioned that stands out to me, especially in this moment where we are in American soccer in 2025, is the political muscle that having a Division I team or a Division I organization and a league structure actually provides you. Because let's go to one quick example, which is Indy 11. Indy 11, as far as I'm aware, had a proposed stadium deal actually approved through the legislature, the local legislature, if I'm not mistaken. And then that was taken back when the MLS organization that they're effectively trying to kill Indy 11 with got some type of deal alongside that with the mayor, which ultimately meant the Indy 11 stadium deal was not approved. Now, Kartik, please fill in the details there. But this is extremely important to keep in mind, because if this is something that is allowed to happen, quote unquote allowed to happen, then at this point, I imagine, from my perspective at least, USL sees this possibility in damn near every place that they have a team. Why wouldn't MLS just come in, show their muscle, and either say to some organization, look, you're going to join MLS under our umbrella, or we will kill you?
Yeah, the Indy situation made this critical, made this absolutely essential that USL do this, because irrespective of what you think of Indy 11's ownership and Ersal, who I admit I worked with in NASL. I was working for NASL when we brought him into the league, was in fact the communications director when we did that press conference with him announcing the team. He's put an incredible amount of his own money, his own investment into that club. And if MLS can come in and just kill a club off where he's invested in a top academy, not just the men's team in the USL Championship, but a top USL Academy team. They have a title-winning USW League team. They built out their infrastructure over the course of the 10 years. No, they don't have a stadium, but they had been working the political process to get that. But what was obvious is, as a second division owner and a second division league, they didn't have quite the political pull, as you mentioned, James, to get it over the line the way MLS does. And MLS can come in and just kill the project. So they can do the same thing in San Antonio. They can do the same thing in Tampa Bay. They can do the same thing in Phoenix. There's nothing stopping them. I think the only USL club strong enough to withstand that assault, once again, is Sacramento. I think if MLS goes to Sacramento, they have to work with the Republic. But in all these other places, they can try and take out the club like they did in San Diego, like they did in Charlotte. Charlotte Independent self-relegated, but that was effectively the same thing, Austin. So in order to keep USL's best markets, best ownership groups, you could argue their two best ownership groups in a way are Tampa Bay and San Antonio, because those are major league owners in other sports. You have to do something like this. And I think U.S. soccer is seen as less of an impediment now, to address your initial point about sanctioning. Yes, U.S. soccer does have to vote on sanctioning. And that was a problem we had with the NASL, where we originally were provisionally sanctioned. It got pulled. Then we got sanctioning reinstated by a single vote. But now U.S. soccer is much more amenable. U.S. soccer is less in the clutches of MLS. That's probably the way I should put it. Just be very direct about it. They're less in the clutches of MLS now than they were when the NASL was attempting to advance and yeah, create a competitive landscape versus MLS.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's obviously a problem here in America that we have deemed online the soccer wars. And I think a lot of people are familiar with that phrase, that hashtag. I forget exactly where I'm seeing this, where I saw this. So I apologize to whoever it was in my whatever realm I saw this that put it out there, and I didn't save it for later. But mentally, I remember the phrasing was just, when will it be okay in America for there to be a healthy lower division soccer league? That's kind of the question. Is Kartik, and I'm sure you have information that you might not even be able to divulge here, but there has to be a point where people who are in the ownership group, not only of leagues, but also of individual clubs, of course, they have to be okay with there being individual, there have to be some lower division teams. That doesn't exist anywhere else in the world, that it everyone is going to be in the first division, right? So at this point, my question is, like, how dire a situation, I guess, is this for USL when they need to create a structure kind of to help maintain their own viability, but also they are trying to do this in a way that allows them, as far as I understand it, to keep a healthy lower division system going. And assumedly, I can only imagine that the way that they make it viable, or a viable option for the owners of lower division clubs, is that ultimately, and like you said, it may not be immediately, but ultimately they introduce some system of promotion and relegation. Is all of this the dire situation that brings that about, or where, you know, where are you seeing all of this going between this USL fighting for its life, maybe, probably not that dire, but them fighting to save their own clubs versus MLS and their maw, their open maw of money that's trying to consume everything?
Yeah, and solidarity is an organizing principle of this sport throughout the world, except in the United States, right?
Yeah.
All the money has stayed at the top in the United States. I mean, this can't be stressed enough. People will get angry. MLS fans will get angry when you say this and talk about, oh, well, there would be nothing in this country without them, blah, blah, blah. We can debate that another time. But the reality at this point is MLS is keeping the money at the top. There isn't the sort of trickle-down effect you see in other countries. There isn't the sort of trickle-down effect you see where there is a commitment to solidarity, whether it's through solidarity payments for youth development. Carlos, you were talking before we got on the air, you and Eureka and James were talking about a player that had come through Tampa Bay United that moved within MLS, and Orlando City collected the solidarity payment because MLS teams will only pay other MLS teams the solidarity payments. That doesn't go on anywhere else in the world, right? And it doesn't go on in Canada. So the MLS teams in Canada actually have to pay solidarity payments to when Vancouver developed Alphonso Davies and they sold him on to Bayern, they had to give a solidarity payment to the Edmonton, whatever his youth club in Alberta was, in the Edmonton area. So this is a uniquely American principle where we think it's better to keep the money at the top. What USL can do differently, even before promotion and relegation is implemented, is with a top flight division that gets the sort of sponsorship deals and media deals and investment that top flight leagues get across the globe, including MLS, they can start using that money and helping lower division teams in the championship, teams in League One, teams in League Two, and on the women's side, and giving them some sort of payment, some sort of maybe vendor break, whatever it is, some sort of cost offset for being in the USL ecosystem. So I see great potential with this because solidarity is a fundamental part of being in a league system globally. The reason we need a second first division in this country is because not only is MLS a closed league, but it's a closed league with a single entity system. So there is no effort to bring other to spread the wealth and widen the pie. And if you're an independent club in MLS Next Pro, they started their own lower division league, as we all know. You're not getting the sort of revenue sharing that MLS owners that are part of the single entity are. So this has tremendous potential from a business perspective. And I think the Papadakis's and Paul McDonough know all these things. The things I'm talking about, they've talked about internally, and they know. I hate to quote Alexi Lalas here because he's been kind of trollish on this whole thing, right? But they have the capability of building a better mousetrap.
Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned Alexi Lalas. I feel like I've seen, by the way, this is like a tangent. I feel like I've seen a generally positive reaction to this from U.S. soccer media, right? Like it seems like people were surprised, right? I think people latched on to the goal of promotion or relegation as being this like really like, you know, attractive thing for a first division USL, you know, league to implement. And I want to get back to that in a minute too, because I think this promotion and relegation aspect has been almost at the center of the Division One USL conversation. But Kartik, you might understand this better than me because you mentioned some of the TV deals that USL has now and the brands they work with being pretty good for a lower league in the United States. And we talked about it being maybe an almost existential move, right? That maybe USL is kind of, in a sense, James, like you said, fighting for its life, right? I mean, we know at one point NASL kind of reached its peak and wasn't really able to sustain itself. And with the USL, Kartik, do you think the USL had sort of reached its own peak as a league and there's no real way to grow anymore in a sustainable fashion? Like, because we see all this expansion.
Yeah.
we can talk about, right? But do you see this move to implement a Division One league as being almost like the natural next step because there's nowhere else to go for USL from here? What do you?
I'll be honest. I mean, I don't want to be an alarmist here. James is right in his instincts. I think USL has been fighting for its survival the last few years since MLS started MLS Next Pro, took over the youth system, which was a gift from US Soccer to take over the MLS Next system. You could feel kind of the walls closing in. And I've been impressed that USL has been able to keep it together, keep expansion going, although we keep seeing timelines slipping, right?
With yes.
Division two teams, yeah. Right? The only new team in the championship this year is a team pulled up from League One.
Yeah.
And a lot of the teams we thought were going to be 25 are now 26. I'm hearing 27 maybe potentially with Milwaukee now. That was supposed to be 24 originally,
if
you remember.
Yeah.
So that slipped. I'm hearing the Des Moines team, the Iowa team, we might be talking about 2028. So wow. I think naturally they needed to do this because what has happened is because MLS launched Next Pro, USL has then had to compete with MLS Next Pro for that next set of markets, that smaller set of markets, the places like Texoma and they didn't. The Santa Barbara is going to be in the championship now, but places like that, smaller markets like that, where Statesboro, Georgia, right, where Tormenta is, those sorts of places, and that's taken them out of kind of the bigger markets they were looking at. And we've seen some other projects fall by the wayside, some USL projects like the one with the Ricketts family in Chicago. Right, the Wrigleyville project fall by the wayside. So I think they need it's the logical next step in their growth, and it also probably ensures their long-term survival because it also is about generating additional revenue for the teams down the pyramid. Because one thing I had been told was that at some point, and this really concerned me from a USL perspective, at some point, even though USL is winning more individual battles with MLS Next Pro for investors and expansion teams, that the cost of USL League One and the travel is so prohibitive compared to MLS Next Pro, where everything is in regions because there are reserve teams all over the place. And MLS might be able to subsidize things, right? So that independent clubs don't go out of business the way the Rochester club did. That there might be one or two clubs that move over in a few years. And once you hit that tipping point and there's an investment group who says, hey, you know, we think it's better to be in a reserve league, what is effectively a reserve league with independent clubs, than being in a fully independent third division, then you begin to have a perception problem. So I'm glad USL is being proactive, not only winning those individual one-on-one battles, but now saying, okay, we're going to take the fight to MLS and we're going to attach a D1 to our built-out league system, which is something MLS doesn't have. And we now have a very clear path. Now, I think they have to link the leagues at some point. I mean, a lot of it is window dressing, unless you have promotion and relegation or you have established partnerships and methods of sharing revenue between that top division and the divisions down the pyramid. But they are closer to that with this announcement than they were 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I think the promotion relegation aspect is almost, like I said, central to the conversation for the casual soccer fan that sees this news and, you know, sees what happens in every other part of the world and thinks, why isn't it happening here? And so I want to get back to that in a second, but what do you think this does for MLS? Because we've seen MLS, like you said, we see the Indy situation and we've seen them kind of be predatory to the USL markets. Do you think this makes MLS double down, get maybe more aggressive in their, I don't know, in the soccer wars, right? In the, what we've dubbed the soccer wars. Where does MLS go from here with this news? Does it kind of just ignore it? Or do you think we'll see a kind of double down of the aggressive nature that we've seen recently?
Publicly, they're ignoring it, right? They don't want to say anything about it. Let's see if a journalist or two questions Garber opening week this week about it. He may just say something like, yeah, they, you know, they can do what they want type of thing about USL. But I do think they're going to get more aggressive in terms of maybe trying to poach USL ownership groups up immediately. Some of these, like we talked about Tampa Bay, San Antonio being teams that meet. Although I have to say, with the Rays Stadium situation and with the hurricane damage to both Tropicana Field and Al Lang Stadium, maybe now is not the time for the Rowdies to be pulled up into another league, into MLS specifically. USL First Division D1 league would be different. But San Antonio, that's an option, although, again, they would have a territorial issue with Austin. But I think maybe they get aggressive in terms of Phoenix, Detroit, Indy. We know what they're trying in Indy. Now, USL announcing this, maybe that heads off the potential movement. And that makes investors who MLS might tempt into saying, because MLS doesn't necessarily get local investors, which is an advantage I think USL has. Most of their clubs are locally owned. You could see a situation where MLS, let's say, was trying to hypothetically get some outside ownership group to put up stakes in Detroit. And now that outside ownership group would say, oh, no, well, now there's a path to D1 for Detroit City, who is much more established. So we're just going to back off. So that could be, there could be that deterrent effect also. But MLS is going to try. There's no question about it. How it plays out is another matter.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've been saving the promotion relegation chat because I feel like there's so much. It's very complex, right? Because we talked about James, we kicked off the conversation with the Division One requirements, right? The requirements for a Division One team that has to have a 15,000 person stadium, be in a metro area exceeding 1 million people, 75% of the clubs. And I want to get into it a little bit because I do think it's really interesting, this prospect of introducing pro rel within the USL, right? Let's just generally, broadly try and put a timeline on it, because think about how complex this would be, right? You have so many teams. You have a lot of teams in smaller markets, obviously, in the USL. But more importantly, there's a stadium conversation, which in the USL Championship, like we said, no teams really have the proper stadiums to meet the Division I rules or regulations or whatnot. How complex is that going to be? If you want to throw in promotion and relegation into the mix, and you have these clubs that are in the Championship and League One and make their way up to the second division and eventually the first division, but they play in 6,000 person stadiums. Do you think we're going to see some sort of flexibility from US soccer on these requirements? Because even just looking at 2027 as a launch date, which, like you said, might be wishful thinking.
And it's also pretty close by.
Yeah.
Even if we're just talking about the launch date for the Division One squads, highly unlikely that we meet all these requirements as a league, right, by the time that comes around. So I'm assuming there's going to be some layer of flexibility there. But what do you think, Hardik? Have you seen this before? I can't really think of when NASL launched, if there was any like flexibility with regulations and
requirements. There was. We had to apply for a few waivers. Including, I mean, one of the most biggest waivers we had to apply for year one was that we had technically more than 25% of our teams outside the United States, because we had teams in Canada, but we also had a team in Puerto Rico, which is part of the United States, but has a different, in terms of this sport, it's not, because they have their own federation, their own national team. So that was one of the waivers we had to, there were stadium waivers we had to get. Al Lang at the time had a, because the pitch hadn't been flipped at Al Lang. So we had to apply for a waiver until Bill Edwards flipped the pitch. So the 3 years David Laxer and Andy Nestor owned the team, we had to apply for a waiver about field size at Al Lang. And then the pitch got flipped, and it's fine now. But at one time, you guys probably remember when the pitch at Al Lang faced the other direction and wasn't regulation. In terms of stadium size, I think they will give a few exceptions, but you can't come in with 12 teams and say 10 of them are under 15,000. Maybe if two or three of them are. Well, right now, actually, in USL Championship, Charleston gets a waiver, because obviously Charleston had a stadium in Blackbaud that was well above the capacity requirement. Since they moved to Patriots Point and sold off Blackbaud to build condos, they've been under. But there will be that sort of flexibility. The metro area requirement has also been a tricky thing. And as I think our viewers know and listeners know, clubs like Hoffenheim in the Bundesliga, Villarreal in La Liga, Burnley, when they've been in the Premier League in the past, they don't need any sort of population requirement. They wouldn't need a population requirement that U.S. soccer has put in the Pro League standards, which makes this whole idea of metro areas and, quote, market size, which Americans seem to be obsessed with, market size, right? Yeah. It's crazy.
Among other things.
Yeah. I mean, look at Hoffenheim. Dietmar Hopp, who founded SAP, right? So he's a huge multi-billionaire. He wanted to give his hometown, he wanted to elevate the club in his hometown. And it's a tiny town, and they get more people at the games than live in the town, right?
Which
we see in college sports in the United States also. So the population requirement is another problem, because if you do pro rel, you have to keep 75% of the clubs above that 1 million threshold for Division I, and 75% of the clubs above the 750 threshold for D2. And that creates all kinds of complications. And currently in the USL Championship, everybody, I believe, is above 750. If Spokane comes up, as is rumored, in a few seasons, then they would be below. But if you talk about a D1 league, and then suddenly El Paso gets promoted, or Lexington gets promoted, and they're below 1 million, you then have this complication of kind of juggling things and maybe denying promotion to a team because of these standards.
Right.
So my hope was that the NASL's lawsuit would be successful, because it would knock out, more than anything, I was concerned about these standards, which I think are prohibitive to someone truly launching an ecosystem that can be competitive and open. But since that lawsuit wasn't successful, and we'll see what happens on appeal, USL is going to have to live by these rules.
Yeah. I think that's so fascinating. And you've mentioned, and we've talked about this before, and I've rambled and, you know, wrote for my student paper when I was still an undergrad about the grasp that U.S. soccer finds itself in under MLS. And I think that's kind of where I'm curious how the next few years go, right? Because there has to be some level of flexibility in these regulations for USL Division One to succeed, for promotion and relegation to actually exist within this ecosystem. Des Moines is a club that, if it comes into USL, has like less than 300,000 people in its metro area, right?
But a club I would point out that has proven through the years that they're older than any club in MLS, actually.
Yeah.
Proven they can draw fans at the Division Four level, or what? Yeah. No, it's really not even Division Four; it's just adult amateur.
Right.
So it's ridiculous that they would be prohibited from being. This is why I don't give the Hoffenheim example just to be a wise ass, and the Villarreal example. I mean, this stuff works in other countries.
Right, and like, yeah, Des Moines Menace draws great crowds for the area it's in, and there's plenty of examples too, right? Like Annapolis Blues.
Annapolis Blues is great. Yeah.
Is incredible, and it's like relatively local to me, and I'm really excited for the summer to come around because I'm gonna go check out a few of their matches. So we've seen it's possible, but I'm curious, and maybe Kartik, you can give your opinion on this too, if we'll ever see, or maybe ever is not the right word, if in the semi-near future we'll see reform to these regulations. I'm not optimistic because of where U.S. soccer finds itself in and the control that MLS has over it.
Yeah.
Obviously, changing these regulations would help the USL, not necessarily hurt MLS, but obviously help a direct competitive MLS. And any thoughts on that? Does that make any sense? Am I rambling here? It seems like it has to happen, but it won't, you know?
It has to happen. I absolutely agree. It has to happen. It hasn't happened to this point, which has disappointed me. I was disappointed USL didn't take a proactive, I guess USL is trying to get sanctioning for this league. So they're saying we're going to meet all these regulations. But I was thinking that the opportunity was there for them to say these regulations, which clearly benefit MLS, right? They crowd out the potential for competition, are hurting us from creating the first truly unified league system and pyramid on the men's side in U.S. soccer history, because you're putting these restrictions on us. We're the only league that had. That now aspires to have a D1 league and has an active D2 and D3 league. And actually, USL League 2 is now sanctioned directly under the Federation, not under USASA anymore. So they've actually fulfilling, once you add this, all four levels on the men's side and two of the four levels on the women's side. And there is a Division 2 women's league to come, I'm sure, for USL. When that comes, we'll see. But if they're going to be able to do this robustly and have the flexibility they need, these pro league standards need to be changed. And in fact, there are in the pro league standards, or maybe not anymore. I should check. But at one time, it exempted single entity leagues from some of the requirements. It said that in writing. There's only one single entity league. So basically everybody else had to live by a set of regulations, USL, NASL, anyone else who might want to apply, and MLS didn't. And we also know with Open Cup, they violated the Pro League standards themselves last year. So that
With no word of any sort of sanction or punishment.
Yeah,
or
anything, no consequence, by the way.
No consequence.
Right. Yeah, and so these things have been selectively enforced through the years, and while it's true, NASL sued after they were denied sanctioning, after having been given lots of waivers. And I mentioned a few of the waivers earlier, including stadium or pitch size, right, at Al Lang. The reality remains that they have been selectively enforced through the years. And at this point, things like the time zone requirements seem absolutely obsolete, because you could make the case that you could develop a competitive first division or second division or third division in a region like a college sports conference, like the footprint of top divisions in Europe. I mean, think about the relative footprint of the Premier League or La Liga or Serie A. And you could do that just on the West Coast, or you could do that just in the Southeast. And you're not able to do that in this country because of the time zone requirement, which when I was at NASL, I have to admit, we thought that was the most absurd of the requirements, the time zone requirement, because we felt like at the Division II level, mitigating travel costs was really important.
Yeah.
So having a concentration of teams, we had obviously four teams in Florida, Jacksonville, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Tampa Bay. And then we had a team in Atlanta. We had a team in Raleigh-Durham or the Railhawks, now North Carolina FC. So you had six teams clustered in the Southeast. That then you have to put a team in Edmonton in order and Minnesota in order to meet a time zone requirement. You're defeating the purpose of the regional cluster with that. So those sorts of things have to change. But Carlos, I agree with you. I'm not terribly optimistic that they're going to for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think that's one of those areas that I'm most curious about going forward, because we just haven't seen much change on that end ever in the history of U.S. soccer, right? Despite the selective, you know, enforcement of said regulations. James, take it over. I feel like I've started rambling here, but yeah, I mean, relevant to the promotion relegation discussion, relevant to the feasibility of Division One, and the existential question of where U.S. soccer will be in 5 to 10 years. Anything on your end, James?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to run down real fast. By the way, you can get this at Beyond the 90. The writer was Callum Ewing. There are teams that are scheduled to join the USL Championship coming up before it makes any type of move about a Division One status. Like Kardik said previously, one club is jumping up. That's Lexington. In the future, Brooklyn FC is supposed to join. They're already running a USL Super League side. Santa Barbara Sky is set to join. We're expecting Ozark United, possibly OKC in the future. That's Oklahoma City Energy, although they have supposedly dropped the energy. And then there are other ones in Garland or Dallas. We already talked about Des Moines and Sporting Jacksonville. There are a bunch of other teams. And I think today, in fact, USL just announced that there was supposed to be a new team coming on board in New Jersey. So all of that being said, this leads me to my question for you, Kardik, here. I think that if there's a prospective owner looking at, or a prospective ownership group, let's say, let's give it all the might that we can, an ownership group is looking from their city to join a league. And they see MLS. MLS has generally a very high cost to join, or you can join the MLS Next Pro. And I don't know what that cost to join is, but it's effectively guaranteed that there's never going to be any movement up or down if you join MLS Next Pro, as far as I understand it. USL at least has a lower entry fee, and then there is this possibility that down the line there is an option that you could change leagues if you so choose. And I feel like that's a little bit more open, but you've already mentioned the cost about travel, so there's also that to take into account as well. There might be some more financial clout behind MLS. What are the draws for each league for somebody who is trying to create a club in a place where there isn't one, or maybe they see that there is room for another one? Because I'm sure that there are tons of cities in this country that could host at least two professional clubs. We don't even have to get into that discussion. But what are the potential draws between one league or the other when somebody is in this situation?
Yeah, so, you know, first off, San Diego, the new MLS club, $500 million to join. That's wow. Crazy number. Newcastle United sold to the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund. We know it's very controversial, right? We don't want to get into the politics around that. But Newcastle United, which is a global brand, and St. James Park, or whatever the stadium is now called with a sponsor, I don't know what, it became Sports Direct because of Mike Ashley, but whatever it's called now, included in the sale, the equivalent of about $375 million. There is no way that you can tell me a new MLS club in San Diego that has no infrastructure, no stadium, no anything is worth more than Newcastle United. So let's just start with that. Lower cost of entry is an advantage for USL. because there is now I think how low the cost of entry is a question, because if it's so low, you're thinking, well, we're not even really joining a first division league.
Right.
Not going to be that much revenue to go around if we're only paying $10 or $15 million to get into this. So the question of how low is a question mark. But I think the advantages for USL are lower cost of entry, the league system where you can move up and move down. We have seen USL teams in the past self-relegate. Most recently, Richmond, who were a D2 team for years, and Charlotte. We've also seen teams move from league, from teams that were D2 teams move all the way down to D4. I'm thinking of clubs like Long Island Rough Riders. Westchester is now moving back up to D3. They had been in D3 years ago. It dropped to D4, now back in D3, although I think it may be a different ownership group now. So there's that flexibility, which you don't have with MLS. But a drawback is I think USL doesn't have the revenue sharing mechanisms. They don't have the league sponsorships, and they don't necessarily have the support system in terms of money if you run into financial trouble. Where MLS has advantages is there's the revenue sharing, there's Soccer United marketing. Although I have to say, Soccer United marketing doesn't do as much as they used to. So when they used to market FC Barcelona in the United States, when they used to be able to bring European clubs over for tours, and when they used to have the rights for Chivas in the United States, and did every Chivas friendly in the U.S., there was more revenue coming in. Now there's not, but they still have the tie-in with Liga MX. They still have the tie-in with the Mexican Federation. So that revenue from some, that check every year to MLS owners offsets a lot of their losses. Because make no mistake about it, most MLS clubs are still losing a ton of money.
Oh, yeah.
But some of it is offset by what you get from some. So part of that $500 million or whatever you're spending to join is also being part of Soccer United marketing. And you do get a piece of the Apple TV deal. But here is where I think the game has changed now in the last few years. I can't stress this enough. I think the door is open for USL to do this because MLS took itself off of mainstream television and put itself on Apple TV. Now, if they had done this sort of deal with Amazon, with Prime or with Netflix, it might be different. But what we found, and I didn't know this completely at the time. And at the time I was doing the media beat for World Soccer Talk. So I was giving pros and cons of moving to Apple TV. I didn't realize what a niche product Apple TV Plus is.
Mm.
And how MLS was limiting its exposure. Now, maybe they were getting more revenue in terms of their TV deal than they'd ever gotten from ESPN and ABC and Fox and Univision. But what they did is they limited their exposure. There's no buzz about MLS out there anymore. Investors are not seeing as much of MLS. Sponsors, I've heard, have complained because they paid big for sponsorship dollars, and those ads are now running behind an Apple paywall. So that was something that has now given USL the opportunity, obviously have a deal with CBS already, maybe launching in 27 or 28, you get more to that deal. But I do think one massive advantage MLS has is that they have basically built out their stadium infrastructure for yes. most of their clubs. And this is something now USL is going to come knocking on the door for. So the strategy, I think, for USL, what we saw with Garland, what we see them trying to pursue in Roswell, Georgia, Garland, Texas, what Miami FC is trying to do in Homestead, I think that's going to be the strategy. In markets where there are already MLS clubs, maybe you go into the suburbs, you go to smaller municipalities, you knock on the door of those municipalities, you tie in a stadium project to a retail development, or there's also the option of just going into other parts of the metropolitan area. I know, obviously, Fort Lauderdale is a D1 club on the women's side, USL Super League side. There's already been talk in the last few days that Fort Lauderdale United might be the most ideal candidate of the South Florida USL entrance to be in this D1 project, even though they don't have a 15,000-seat stadium. So that's an issue. because they've done it on the women's side. So since they've launched on the women's side, although we have to say D1 women is almost like D2 on the men's side in terms of the requirements. So when people have pointed out this out to me about For Lord Love, said, look, I get that, but that's like running a D2 men's club. This is that much higher of a threshold. But I think what USL is going to think is that they need to go into kind of neighborhoods of larger markets. Brooklyn's an example of that too, right? Westchester could potentially be an example of that in the New York metropolitan area. Maybe there's a project in LA County that's outside of Los Angeles, maybe in Long Beach or someplace that they get involved with. MLS still has the advantage, but I think the price point's lower for USL, and maybe the visibility for USL is going to be better because once Messi leaves MLS and MLS is tied down to this Apple deal for another 7 seasons.
They've got nothing.
Yeah, they've got nothing. And if USL is on mainstream television and the American public, they can only discern superstars from regular players. So if you don't have Messi, Ronaldo, Ibra, De Bruyne, right, this level player, all the up, you know, it's kind of a 6 of one, half dozen of another. I think USL's got a fighting chance.
Now, the only other issue, though, of course, when it comes to costs, like you said, MLS does have the amount that they can spread out or they can give to people who have to travel more. So right now, somebody like, let's say, AV Alta down in USL League One, you and I have talked about them a bunch, Kardik. Yeah. They probably did not expect that their closest opponent was going to be in Spokane, Washington in the year 2024. And then they found out what, like we did in November and December, that all of a sudden that's going to be their closest opponent. And you know, they're just out of luck, or at least for the time being. But in the meantime, you know, they have to make do, and they have to get past that. And hopefully they can last long enough to the point where it actually gets a little bit more viable overall. But with this being with that truth for the USL clubs on the horizon, my assumption is that USL is making these moves because they need to prove their own viability, like I said earlier, but they also want to do something that forces MLS to consider solidarity. At this point, I imagine that MLS is doing everything it can to kill everything that they don't own, like we've seen with the Open Cup even. Kardik, do you think that this move, it would require a lot of stuff that we haven't seen yet? It's going to require a lot of stuff that all of these teams that we just talked about all need to build soccer specific stadiums over 15,000 people. That's huge. That's millions and millions and millions of dollars. If they can somehow pull some modicum of this grand idea off, do you think that that might force MLS to consider solidarity and actually work with an opponent as opposed to just digging their heels in and going the back routes and trying to cut off all these stadium deals, you know, even before they get started, let's say?
That's a big question.
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think MLS has the mentality that they care about the health of the rest of the pyramid. And what you said a minute ago is now fact, right? MLS very clearly is trying to cut off the head of anything they don't own, and that Soccer United Marketing is not responsible for marketing. That was theoretical when I was at the NASL. We said, you know what, MLS wants to control soccer, but at the time they created a partnership with USL. They had, and I think this is now public knowledge, they had talked to us at NASL. We had been close to doing the deal with them before it fell apart, and they did the deal with USL instead to put their reserve teams, et cetera, in USL. And they were putting their youth teams in the U.S. soccer development academy and in some cases in other U.S. youth soccer, U.S. club soccer entities. But we thought theoretically they wanted to control everything. Now it's factual. Now it's absolutely factual. They have their own youth system. All of their clubs are in the MLS Next system. They have tried to poach the best youth clubs that were in other youth leagues and move them to MLS Next. They have created their own third division league. They have basically, after not doing anything to market the Open Cup in the Let me count here. From 2005 to 2022.
Let's just real quick. Let's just not forget when MLS says that it's not a good, it's not a well-known competition. That is largely their own fault.
Yeah. 18 years, Soccer United Marketing was a marketing agency of record and the media rights holder for the U.S. Open Cup. I mean, I could get into stories about how much trouble I had when I was at the NASL, even getting SUM to stream certain games because they didn't want to see a lower division team knock out an MLS team. We had issues with that in 2012 and 2013. Now suddenly it's not a well-known competition. It's in bad stadiums. It's not marketed properly. They make this critique a year after U.S. Soccer takes the rights back from them. So the issue there was they weren't controlling it. And that's why they launched Leagues Cup. They wanted a competition they controlled and they marketed. So how do they come around to showing some solidarity with the rest of the pyramid? Maybe USL just has to build, I hate to quote Wallace again, but has to build that better mousetrap. And build that better mousetrap, that means then MLS has no choice but to work with you in the future. But for now, I don't think they will. I think they're going to try and crush this thing out of the gate.
Yeah, I'm generally inclined to agree with you on that one, which obviously sucks for us who are fans of this league. It sucks for, I would say, probably to a broader audience of people who generally just like soccer in America and would prefer it to grow as opposed to being, I would say, a plaything of a couple of rich people who are allowed to make it as they see fit and change it to fit their own ideals. But that's, I guess, a little bit more conversation than we need to get into tonight. Carlos, I have asked the last couple of questions here. If you've got anything more for Kartik, we've obviously gone a good little while on this, but you know, it's a big subject.
Yeah, no, this is great. This is great. And I think we've had a generally good tone on this episode, by the way. I feel like I was worried we'd get a little pessimistic, as we tend to do when we talk about the broader scope of U.S. soccer. But I think there's a lot of good things here. And I think there's a lot of positives to take away from this. People are very validly excited for this. And you know, the questions that come with this, there's going to be challenges, sure. But I think this is really exciting from a personal, obviously. You know, we're here talking about the Rowdies and what the future holds for the Rowdies and the league they're in, Division One, promotion, relegation. Like, these are all exciting buzzwords for not just us who are sickos talking about lower league soccer on a Tuesday evening, but the casual soccer fan in the U.S., right, who hears this news and hears pro rel and gets a little excited. Like, for example, shout out Harry Austin, who on the YouTube comments is giving a hello from San Antonio. Giving a shout out to Kartik's knowledge as well. But for example, talking about San Antonio, right? I will almost certainly be at that game in San Antonio, by the way, this year, because one of my great friends from Georgetown, fraternity brother of mine, Mexican background, could not really give two anythings about U.S. soccer or MLS or whatnot. He was a big fan of Monterrey and his Mexican club back in Liga MX. But this news of USL got on his radar, and he started talking about it with folks, you know, in my fraternity and with me, and sickos who don't really care about soccer for whatever reason have messaged me and like friends. Like, anecdotally, you see excitement and the buzz around this. And he's already saying, he said he already is going to go to that game against the Rowdies in San Antonio just because he's curious to check out a local game now. Like,
yeah,
just anecdotally, in the last week, I've already seen more conversation around USL than I have maybe ever, you know.
Right.
And that's cool. If nothing else, it's a great place that we're in right now, that people are talking about our clubs, people are talking about the USL and potentially what the future has in store. So my last optimistic hoorah question for you, Kartik, is 2027, maybe 2028, right? This is something I tweeted out about last week. MLS did the same thing following a World Cup in the United States, launched their league 2 years later after that World Cup. it was around that time, riding the momentum of soccer in the country after the World Cup here in the 90s. Do you think we'll see that level of excitement here with the 2026 World Cup? I'm pretty optimistic about it. And do you think that is actually going to help launch the excitement of this league too?
Great question, Carlos.
great question, Carlos. And hi, Harry. It's great to talk to you. Harry and I talk often. He's one of the most knowledgeable lower division fans you'll find in the U.S. So great to hear from him. And I threw in a Newcastle reference for him earlier. I know he was watching, but threw in a Newcastle reference for him. The thing about this World Cup is I think 94 was a blank canvas this country. And I know we learned during that World Cup that Tampa was getting a team, the mutiny and the ill-fated mutiny. So there was, and it took a while to build to kind of capture that excitement and channel it to the new league. But in 96, MLS did very well. Attendances were very good. Obviously, the Mutiny were the best team in 96, even though they lost in the playoffs, right? They won. Posthumously were awarded the Supporters' Shield. They didn't give a regular season title in those days. But I think this time, and then it kind of faded after that, MLS, and it didn't regain that momentum until Beckham came. 2007. Mm-hmm. So quite frankly, like 96 was the high point, and then it gradually faded to the point where I think 2004, 2005 were like the really low points of MLS, even though the national team was doing very well at the time, right? It had a great run in the 2002 World Cup. I think this World Cup is probably going to have more of an impact. This might sound very cynical. I think it's going to have more of an impact on the Canadian Premier League in terms of getting new investment and excitement in Canada, and them getting maybe 4 to 6 new clubs between 2026 and 2030. I think in the U.S., what we're finding is maybe you'll engage some new fans, but what really has kind of happened is that the availability, the difference in 94, we knew nothing about European football in the United States. I mean, I knew a little bit, but I was following it. I was getting the paper like a week late. Then the papers from the UK following things. And even up until, I think, when MLS began to have problems, 98, 99, 2000, that time period was because for the first time we were getting Premier League matches in the United States. And then we began getting La Liga and Bundesliga and Serie A matches. And actually, I would say in 2000, that time period, Serie A was the best league in the world. So once we got matches from Italy, on top of the matches that we began getting from England, remember, the first year Fox showed matches from the Premier League was the 98-99 season. And I knew right away, as someone who was an MLS fan at the time, geez, you know, this is once people are exposed to this, they're not going to want to watch MLS. And that kind of continued. I think where we are now is we've had so much exposure to top-level club football in the United States. And NBC, obviously, I mean, a big part of it was the Premier League moving to NBC. And I think while that's been unfortunate for the Bundesliga, La Liga, and Serie A, as I think fairly comparable, I think, you know, all four leagues, you can throw them in a bin, and in a given year, one league is better than the other. I don't think there's definitively the Premier League or La Liga is better than those other two leagues. But because of the NBC deal, the Premier League is all over in the United States, right? And other leagues aren't. So I don't think the World Cup is necessarily going to give the bump, the huge bump it did in 94. I think it will give a slight bump, but the interest and exposure that European football, particularly the Premier League, has been given in the United States has stimulated investment. And I've noticed even as new lower division teams launch, there's always some tie to trying to get fans that are watching not just the U.S. men's and women's national team, but Premier League matches or La Liga matches or Bundesliga matches in the door. Now, the other thing I would mention about this is I think 2027 looms as a large year, because I think coming off of that World Cup will have a lot of momentum in this country. And I'm assuming the United States, I don't know, gets to the round of 16. That's what they always do, right, in the men's tournament. Maybe the quarterfinals. Canada, Mexico, maybe the expectations are similar. Although I feel like Canada has a particularly good set of players now, so maybe maybe their expectations can be a little higher. But 2027, I think with Emma Hayes managing the women's team, we are once again the favorites to win the Women's World Cup. So if we follow up hosting a Men's World Cup with winning the Women's World Cup the next year, which I should mention, I'm sorry, I'm rambling for a while here, but I think a big thing in the launch of MLS that people forget about was, yes, we hosted the World Cup in 94, MLS launched in 96. Even though a lot of people didn't get to see it because it was on pay-per-view in this country, the U.S. having the run they did in the Copa America in 1995 down in Uruguay, that made people think, oh my gosh, we got something going on, because we beat, and I think it wasn't even just that we made the semifinals. I think that was less relevant than we beat Argentina in the tournament, which, who knows if we'll ever have another competitive win against Argentina in history. So that was kind of some of the marketing behind MLS in 96. It wasn't, these were the heroes of the World Cup where we got out of the group stage and we hosted. It was like, these are the guys who beat Argentina in the Copa America, in Uruguay, close to the Argentine border. So I'm thinking also of 27. We follow up hosting a World Cup with a Women's World Cup triumph. Then I think that really stimulates more interest and growth in the sport.
And it should be noted real quick that 2027 is also when the USL's current TV deal, as far as I'm aware, will be up. And then they will have to renegotiate either with somebody new or, try to expand the existing deals they already have. And of course, they will be looking to add on to their dollar figure there. But yeah,
Money's coming.
That's the goal. But Kartik, we have taken so much of your time and always very appreciative of you giving it to us, of course, because you have so much knowledge related to not only the sport overall, but in particular, how these leagues work and how they go about making themselves viable or inviable or whatever it might be. So thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, thank you, Carlos. Thank you, James. Thank you, Eureka, behind the curtain. And hopefully successful season for the Rowdies coming up. I'm more optimistic than a lot of people are about the Rowdies this season. So maybe I'll come back soon and we'll discuss that. And maybe I'm totally wrong. Obviously, they're going to start the season away from home because of Al Lang, the situation with Al Lang. So maybe we'll be I'll have egg all over my face in a month.
Yeah, John had us USL Tactics, and he had us like sixth in the power rankings in the East, or the standings predictions. Now, I felt like those were a little harsh. I feel pretty good about where squad's at. There's the Eastern Conference again is so much deeper in quality and depth than the Western Conference, I think. But we can talk about this again forever, by the way. Plenty of Rowdies content still coming out. If you're listening to this live, get ready for a double dose of Rowdies content coming out later this week as well. A lot of RBLR content coming out, including the interview with one of the new Rowdies players who's joining the squad this year from the CPL. Pretty much gave it away there. But that'll be a good one as well. He had a great chat with us about his favorite foods. James, I loved talking about Nando's with him. We'll get into that later on as well. Nando's. we'll have notes from the Montreal preseason game as well. Some positives over there. Kartik, I think you're right. I think I'm biased, but I do think we look better than some folks might say. West is best. Some people are saying that, I guess. Harry. I don't know how many
of the title, the Western Conference teams, even though I feel like the East is better every season, but then the West will always have that one team, whether it's San Antonio or Sacramento or Phoenix, right? Yeah. That's Orange County that are capable of winning the title.
Colorado Springs
last year, right?
Yeah, it's a great point. It's interesting. It is interesting. They had the Rowdies touch though last year with Juan Tejada on that squad. So we take a little credit for that title.
Yeah.
Kartik, thanks for joining us. James, anything we should throw in here as we start to wrap up this part one of the RBLR content for the week?
Well, I was just going to say, Kartik, if you will, plug all of the stuff that you're still working on, your own Florida Soccer Pod and Behind the 90, all that, if you will, please.
Yeah, so James is actually my co-host on the Florida Soccer Report. So check us out. You can subscribe on we're on Substack at beyondthe90.net. You can subscribe on Spotify. You can subscribe on Overcast. Someone told me this week they were able to link our podcast to Apple Podcasts, which I didn't realize because I keep sending messages to Apple, please add us. But we're definitely on Spotify, 100% on Spotify. Maybe we're on Apple now too. That's the Florida Soccer Report with James and me every week. We're actually going to launch. We're going to split our podcast into men's and women's coming up here pretty soon. So we'll have two pods a week. And then beyondthe90.net for all your lower division content, lower division US content, and some European content. We don't cover MLS. So if you're interested in MLS, there are plenty of other places you can get your content. But if you're into USL or NPSL or NISA, now the league for clubs also, and any women's USL related league, USLW League or USL Super League, we're home for beyondthe90.net.
I'm trying to cover all the teams in Florida, as many as are coming online real quickly.
There's a
right
lot.
Now.
Yeah, there's a lot. Once you start to pay a little bit of attention, you peel back the layer, you start to see all the fun clubs around our little state. James, where can people follow you?
I am mostly on Twitter at this point, at RBLRJamesK, if you want to follow me. And Carlos, what about yourself now?
Thanks for asking, James. I appreciate it. At CarlosTPA10 on Twitter, most of my stuff over there. Rowdy season's almost coming up, and I'm so excited. I'm thrilled. I'm already looking at tickets to get around to. I'm trying to break my away games record this year, which isn't a lot. It's only three. So if I hit four this year, I'll be really happy. San Antonio is one of them, Harry. Pittsburgh. Loudon. I'm not counting Loudon. Loudon doesn't count. It's too close.
Okay, yeah, it's a home game for you.
Yeah, it's just too close. So there's a few in there. And come join me at Carlos CPA10, and we'll keep talking Rowdies. A little bit of Georgetown basketball as the season comes to an end now. Follow us at RBLR Sports on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, Threads, anywhere you get content, we're there. Smoke signals, probably we can find a way to put out content via like pigeons and what, I don't know. Like and subscribe to the podcast, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, right? We're there. Thanks for joining us live. If you're watching this on a Tuesday evening, if you're listening to this recorded, get ready for a double dose because the other thing's probably out now too. So enjoy that now. You have another 40, 50 hour of content from RBY this week. So enjoy that. James, anything else to wrap up?
No, at this point, just want to say for an apparent USL Division I league coming online, we're going to leave it here. Come on, you Rowdies.
Thank you for tuning into this presentation by RBLR Sports. On your way out of the stadium, please remember to like and subscribe.